y'all can blame Danny. Now, he's the one that invited him up here. He's, so y'all can vote him out of the group or whatever.
My name is C.D. Collins. I'm an alcoholic high of a body. And the reason I'm here is because I was asked to come. And the reason I go and do what I'm asked to do is because I prayed to God when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. If I could stay sober, I would do what I was asked to do in AA. I no longer get a big ego trip out of talking, and I'm not trying to impress anybody with what I say. And what I say is my own personal opinion. For God's sakes, remember that. And my wife's up here with me. We have a son in Atlanta, and she stayed out in Atlanta to visit him, be with him some. He works for Merrill Lynch down there. Kid, it's his first year out away from home, and so we have a strong attachment for him. So anyway, she stayed down there, and I'm glad she did, because when I was not with him, the story's a little different, you know, because God, we got a lot of memories, and I have to really be careful up in this neighborhood from Marietta right down the road here. Is where it all went to hell with Ida and myself, and that's where this lady left me and divorced me, right from Marietta, Georgia. And we were not able to come back to Marietta for about 23 years before we were able to go back and go by the house where it all took place, ladies and gentlemen. That's how bad it was. And if I told it as it really happened, there wouldn't be anybody in here. You couldn't stand it. You'd have to say, hell, let me out of there. I don't hear that crap. Let me go, you know. So I tell it kind of in a high-class way, you know, and you read into it whatever you want to. I didn't start out in life to be an alcoholic. That wasn't my ambition. And by the way, I've been sober since October 21st, 1957. And I am a gutter drunk. I lost it all as a result of drinking liquor. Some of y'all have heard me, and I'm not going to make any apology about that. Everything went out of the tube as a result of my drinking liquor. And I didn't start out in life to be a drunk. I've never run into anybody say, well, I believe I want to be a damn alcoholic. I haven't run into those. Well, I think I'll go to AA. You ever run into? No, that ain't the reason you come to AA either. There's something behind that deal when you walk in the doors of this thing. You know, either job or wife or the penitentiary or something that's hanging over you. But my ambition in life was not to be an alcoholic. I was raised up on a farm down in South Georgia, mother and daddy. Sacrificed a lot to give me an education, and me and my sister and brother. I went to church and Sunday school on a regular basis. My mama was Primitive Baptist. Now, y'all might know what a primitive, an old-line Primitive Baptist. Some of y'all may know what that is. And they didn't use lipstick in my mother and her church. They didn't put the powder on them, and you didn't cut your hair. They had it in a long thing and tied it in the ball. See you later on the hip. That's what it was. I went to church and Sunday school, left out the doors open. And it had these bush arbors, and it had lamps. See a guy nodding, he's a little boy. But anyway, they preached hellfire and damnation, you know. And I never forget, they're sitting in there as a little boy. I don't know if y'all ever heard of this or not. You're going to burn in hell forever if you do certain things. And if you think about it, you have committed the sin. Any of y'all ever heard that? If you think about it. I got about 13, I began to think about some things. And Lord God, I knew I was going to hell. You know, right there, that takes care of it. You think, how am I going to stop from thinking? So I began to think about some things. And the reason I started drinking liquor is because the ladies were drinking liquor. That's the reason. Had a lady in my class that drank that stuff. And I liked her, and she's had a good looking and had a nice automobile on. I thought, God, I'm going to get in with this crowd. So anyway, I started trying to learn how to drink. I don't know about y'all, I had a hell of a time trying to learn how to drink. You know, I don't think you just start and have a success at it. I wouldn't. Every time I'd go out with her, every time I'd date her, I'd wind up drunk and she'd carry me home and take my car home. It was embarrassing, very embarrassing, the whole deal. And I worked at a drugstore as a soda jerk. Some of y'all might be old enough to remember what a soda jerk is. I was a soda jerk at the local drugstore there. And our pharmacist, his name was Frank Davis, and never forget, Frank's dead. Now, anyway, I was having this problem about winding up drunk. And I asked Frank, I said, Frank, what can I do? Every time I take this girl out, I go to drink and look, and I wind up drunk, and she carries me home, you know, and God, she was good looking. He said, C.D., come on, get you some extra heavy mineral oil just before we go out on a date. Take that and it'll coat your belly, and then you drink liquor, and it won't get to you, you know. And I said, man, now are you talking? So anyway, I had a date with a girl on Saturday night at a local juke joint out of town. And some of y'all go over and remember juke joint, play these tear-jerking songs and dance and all. Anyway, it sold beer. I went by a drugstore and got me a half a pint of extra heavy mineral oil. And it's so damn thick you had to chew it, swallow it, get it down. And I finally got it down, you know. And I thought, well, boy, tonight, you know, I'm going to be with it tonight. I picked this lady up. We went out there, and I thought, tonight, honey, drink for drinking. Now we back up. We started drinking. To make a long story short, I went out drunk as hell and messed up my pants. That wound that deal up. Don't try that. That won't work. Nada doesn't like that. She gets mad. You want to tell her that's ugly. You know. But that's the way it happened. You know. So I didn't try no more damn mineral oil. My wife, who is a beautiful lady, some of y'all have seen her, Danny has. She's a beautiful lady today. And if you look at her, and a lot of people who see her in the door said, oh, she's the kindest, sweetest person I've ever met. But I'm married to a woman that will kill you. She's got bad blood. But I'm serious. She was a Kennedy, C-N-E-D-Y, and the Kennedys will kill you. All of them would. You know, it's just bad blood. You know, I'm married into the family, and I got them, and that's it. I love them very dearly, but I'd have put you away, you know, and if I'd had any sense early in my drinking career, I would have known something was wrong, because I come in one afternoon, now y'all gonna read into this, I come in one afternoon from work, and I was getting undressed to take a shower, and I was sitting on the side of the bed taking clothes off, and my father had given me a nickel-plated Colt 45. It was in the top dresser and had 6 bullets in it. And she just reached up as I was getting undressed and opened the drawer and took out this 45 and cocked it and pointed right at me. She was close to me then and said, tell me all about it. And hell, I didn't know what it was. I began trying to think which it was and what it, you know, that thing getting, my mind went crazy, you know, trying to figure out what it was. Because I knew I was fixing to die. I'm serious. I knew hell I was gone. I could see the undertakers, the whole bit, the whole funeral in a split second. When I thought, God, I'm going to die, sure as hell. My first indication since I got rabbit blood is to run. You know, I thought, if I run out by and start down the hall, but she is an excellent pistol shot. It still is today. I said, she'll shoot me right between the damn shoulder blades. I start down the hall. Started to jump through the window, and I thought, no. Then I started doing something I became very good at. Some of you alcoholics will do it. I fell in the floor and started crying and begging. I kept saying, don't shoot me, you're going to hurt me, you know, God. And I finally got a little idea what it was and put a little doubt in her mind that it didn't happen. And she talked a couple weeks ago in Alabama, and it's the first time she's ever, but she told it. She told it for the first time I was, and first time I was ever acknowledged that thing. And it was, she would kill me, and wasn't any doubt about it. And you read about it every day in the paper, she would have killed me. It was something that happened, and she would have killed me about it. Had I not put a little doubt in the mind of what she thought happened, did not happen. But I tell you one thing, she cut out the it business right there. That brought that to a screeching halt. But then, to make a long story short, as I went to, I don't get on a damn long drunk log here. I went to law school. My mother and dad educated me, went to law school, and finished law school here in Atlanta, Georgia, and World War II came along, and I wanted to be a pilot. I'd started flying over Citadel when I was going there. And I wanted to be a pilot. I went in World War II and became a fighter pilot. I flew P-40s early part of the war, the old short-nosed job, and then P-47s, the Jug later on, the Thunderbolt. And then after the war, I flew P-51s. But anyway, I went through the war. It's no big deal as with alcohol. Well, I drank on occasions, but I was not addicted to it and was able to handle it. I came out, came back to Atlanta, Georgia, moved down in Marietta, Georgia. Had a house there and lived in Fair Oaks. Some of y'all may know where I'm talking about. I lived in Fair Oaks and I worked in Atlanta in the old Belle Isle building there for the Veterans Administration as an attorney. And went back to and then flew out at Dobbins Air Force Base. Flew for the National Guard. I like to fly very much and I stayed in the Guard and I continued to fly and I continued to drink liquor. And I and I both looking back now, we look at the thing, it kept increasing on it, the amount we were drinking. And in the beginning, we drank just to have fun and the pleasure and whoever. And if it had whiskey, fine. If it didn't have whiskey, it didn't bother us. But as time went on, it began to take more to do what it had been doing. Now, this is hindsight, certainly not. And I would fly all around the countryside. We would, all these fighter pilots in the 128th Fighter Squadron. I say that out because some of y'all might have been a part of that outfit. We had a reunion last year down at the Marriott Hotel. Anyway, we'd fly to Dallas and to Miami and to Washington 8 or 10 or 15 of us and get roaring drunk over the weekend, you know, and stay drunk and have one heck of a time. We'd come dragging back Sunday afternoon or whatever. But I was always getting weathered in. You know, I'd weather in. And you can read what you want to in that weather in. I'd weather in. And you know. I'd call Ida back and tell her I'd weathered in. And she'd say, don't take off if the weather's bad, honey. Don't stay on the ground. And I called her from Washington one time and I'd weathered in. And Mary Barrett over at Dick Barrett's wife, she's one of those smart, you know what, wives. And anyway, she was over at my house and I called Ida about the weather. And Mary said, let's call Dobbins Air Force Base and find out what the weather is. You know. God, that never occurred to Ida in her life, you know. So Mary got on the damn phone, got over there and called and got the weather office on the phone. Said, what's the weather in Washington, D.C.? He said, the weather's clear and the visibility is unlimited up there today. That was on Sunday. I come dragging back Tuesday when I got home. And Ida confronted me with this information about the weather. Like all good alcoholics, all y'all know. I said, listen, Ida, you can't find out what the weather is in Washington, D.C. That's top secret, isn't it? And if you call over anymore, check it on me, and I'm flying these highly classified missions. You know, you're going to get me in a world of trouble. You know, and God, I'll begin to lie through my teeth about everything. And most of us who are alcoholics begin to lie about everything. And I began to lie about everything. We got jets out there at 49 at Dobbins Air Force Base. Transferred P-51 to head in into jet aircraft. And let me say something, ladies and gentlemen. I don't know if y'all have been around airplanes a lot, but this is part of my story. I'd never been in a jet aircraft in my life, but we got jet aircraft, and they were going to let us fly the jet airplane. And the first jet I was ever in, I flew it by myself. There wasn't nobody else in there with me. Now, you think of the trauma connected with this. I've been flying an airplane that cruised about 250 miles an hour. They put me in one that cruised at 450 miles an hour, and they put me in a damn airplane that's got a little canopy comes over your head, and it's got a hole right down through the middle, comes between your legs, and go out and back, and it's a blowtorch. You strike a match, and light the fire, and the damn thing goes. It's that simple. And they put me in this thing my day come to fly that thing, and I was terribly disturbed about having to fly. But I had to if I was going to stay in it. And then what they did, they had you instructor. Everybody's seen this. Had an instructor that's in another airplane. He's the guy that's your instructor, and he followed you. I got in the airplane and buckled in. He stood up on the wing and talked to him, and they struck a match, and we lit the fire, and we talked. And I said, okay, you taxi out, and I'll follow you out in my airplane. So he got in his airplane, followed him out to the end of the runway, and I got out there, told the tower, you know, I was okay. And they said, okay, we turn you over to your instructor. And they turned me over to the guy, a guy by the name of Patillo, who was sitting behind me in the chase plane, and they turned me over to him, and I talked to him, and he asked me about what all was going on in the cockpit, and I told him, and he said, you ready to go? And I said, yeah. And so I just reached up and shut it up to 100% and released the brakes and let her go. And down the runway it goes. About halfway down the runway, this blue smoke began to boil up between my legs. I thought, oh, God, it's on fire. I snatched my glove off and ran my hand down. The damn thing was cold. It was air conditioned. I didn't know the damn thing was air conditioned. I pulled it in the air, and I was literally so scared, I didn't do nothing. I just pulled it back. I said, oh! And away we go. And old Patillo's falling. At about 10 minutes, Patillo said, Collins, you better make a turn. You're already in Alabama. Hell, I was clean out of steam going. I was going west, and I was in Alabama. Well, no question about it. That thing's cruising 450 miles an hour. I was clean into Alabama. Never had made a turn to the mouth open. Just looking at it, scared to death. I came back in landed the aircraft, and I wouldn't be here talking tonight if it wasn't the easiest airplane in the world to fly. A jet airplane is the easiest aircraft in the world to fly. If you get the fire burning, it'll go, and that's all it is to it. You know, long as the fire's on, long as she's on fire, you okay with you, and you go. Anyway, I learned to fly the jet aircraft and continued to drink liquor. And I was called back on active duty in 1950 in the Korean conflict right out at Dobbins Air Force Base, the 128th Fighter Squadron, what I was in, and called back on active duty. And I told Ida, I said, well, we're going back in, and I'm going to stay in. Our office ended movement, Atlanta out to Dobbins Air Force Base, and I was working with the VA out there at Dobbins Air Force Base as an adjudicator, a lawyer, a judge, or what have you with the government. Anyway, put the uniform back on, we went back in, and I wound up at Pope Field, up at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, at TAC headquarters, flying up there. Flying jet aircraft, going around the countryside, putting on demonstrations, showing the Army what the jets could do. And I ran into a colonel up there that he and I became very good friends. He loved liquor and loved flyer planes and loved to have one heck of a big time. We became very good friends, and his wife and my wife became very good friends. Anyway, to make a long story short again, I got orders to go overseas. He tried to keep me from going overseas. He says, "You're a good officer." And I was not a good officer. I was a good pilot. Loved liquor. That was my qualification. But he tried to keep me and was unable to do it. Anyway, they gave us a farewell party at his home before I was going up to Langley Field for staging to go into Korea, into Korea and go into action. And they gave us a big party over at his house, over Colonel Douglas' house. And we all went, I don't know when he only been around an Air Force drunken pilot, brawl, but it's one of the most damnedest things you'll ever witness. They get the hugging and the kissing and throwing each other in pools and all this kind of stuff. It's the craziest mess you've ever seen. And they had this wild party over at the Colonel's house, and about 5 o'clock in the morning, he said, "Collins, can you fly a B-25? And if I'm drunk, I can fly anything. At least I think I can." I said, "I'm the best B-25 pilot you've ever seen." He said, "Would you take me down to Lawson Field in the morning, Columbus, Georgia?" I said, "I'll be glad to, Colonel." I'd overheard part of the conversation. She come over and said, "Honey, you can't fly no B-25. I said, "Hell, he's drunk and I'm drunk. We're not going anywhere. Forget it." The party broke up by daylight and we went home. They were on the base. We got to the house, just got in the bedroom, and the colonel drove up across the lawn in his big Cadillac and blowed the horn, hollered, "Let's go!" I put the uniform on, staggered out the door, and got in the car. We drove down to the flight line at Pope Field, pulled up in front of operations, and I looked right out in front of operations, and there set a B-25. Now, I knew what a B-25 looked like. I taxied by them all over the country. Never had been in one, but I saw one sitting out there and I recognized it. So we got out and went in. He filled out a clearance to go to Lawson Field, came back out. A sergeant came up and saluted and said, "Colonel, your aircraft are ready to go." We staggered out to the airplane. I thought we were playing a game. I thought, "Well, we're quitting, going back to Oslo, start drinking some more liquor." Got an airplane, "So you go first?" I said, "No, you go first. I've never been in one in my life." There's a ladder comes down between the main gear, and you crawl right through the belly of it. Said, "You go first." I finally went up in it, and I thought, "Well, hell, I'll play with it." I went up in it and sit down on the back seat, and then the colonel come up to it, and I thought, "Well, we're going as far as I can go with it, you know." And I said, "Listen, Douglas," I didn't even call him colonel. I said, "Listen, Douglas, I can't fly no B-25. He said, "Hell, you said you could. Let's go." I thought the sergeant was going to faint. If I'd have been him, I'd have just walked off that old deal. I just got out and left. And I turned to him. I said, "Can you crank it up?" He said, "Yes, sir." I said, "Well, get in the right seat and crank it up." He got in the right seat, buckled in, cranked it up. I got in the left seat and buckled in. He got the fans turning. I looked around at the maze of instruments in there. Some of them were recognized, some of them didn't. I said, "Where does the fuel go?" He said, "All feeds into one main tank. You draw off the main." I said, "Fine." I didn't know what to do, so I called the tower and asked the taxi instruction. They cleared me out at the end of the active runway when I got out there. I thought it ought to be a lot you check on a B-25 is in a fighter, but I didn't know. So I just reached up and caught the brakes with my toes and took the throttles and pushed them all the way forward. And everything went up into the green. And if everything goes up into the green, anybody's in the Air Force knows it means it ought to go. If you look right across the instrument panel and everything's in the green, that means it ought to go. You know, if anything's on a caution line, a red line, you know you can't go. But everything was in the green, so I called the tower and told them I was ready to go. And they cleared me on the active runway, and I pulled the code of that B-25 and down the runway we go. About halfway down the runway, the thought occurred to me, this is a hell of a way to die. I wasn't even excited about it, you know. Because y'all think, if you will, I got a colonel in on the back seat passed out, a sergeant in the right seat, and I'm in the left seat. 3 people on board, nobody can fly the airplane. Nobody. I get it in the air, and he cleans it up. He gets the wheels up and the flaps up, and we head out for Lawson Field. About an hour out of Pope Field, liquor died out. If you're an alcoholic, you'll understand the next remark. Panic set in. When it dawned on me that I was the pilot. We're going through there, and I come to it, and I'm in the left seat. There's a sergeant over here, and the colonel passed out in the back, and we're going through the air. I like to die. I didn't know what to do. I said, "Go back and get that colonel up and get him up here and help me land this damn thing." You know, I didn't know what I was going to do with it. I went back and tried to get him up. He couldn't get him up. He come back up and pull up my headset. And he said, "The colonel said come in over in the runway about 125 miles an hour. Chop the power and it should land." That's exactly what I did. I made a beautiful landing. down at Lawson Field. We got out in the officer's club. I drank 3 double martinis and flew the damn thing back. That's insanity. Any way you take it, that's total insanity. Anything in the world that happened, we'd all die. And that'd be any minor thing could occur. I went on overseas in southern part of Japan, Fukuoka, down at Idizuki Air Force Base. I toss these names out every now and then because every now and then some guy stands up and says, yeah, I was over there, you know. Anyway, I went in the southern part of Japan, got down there. I left out in the States with 2 small children, pregnant with the third. And I got away and I found out I didn't want to fight. I didn't want to die. I didn't want to be there. And I was there. And I began to drink liquor because I needed to drink. And this is a dead giveaway. There again, this is hindsight. This is when I went in the point of no return in alcoholism. I began to drink liquor because I needed it. I was very fearful. I didn't want to fight. So I reached down every morning next to my bunk and picked up a 40-ounce jug of Seagram's VO that cost $1.50 to turn and drink right out of the bottle. I'd have 4 or 5 drinks. I'd go down for briefing. There'd be anywhere from 30 to 75 of us pilots in this big briefing room. This guy'd get up on a platform like this, and he'd pull them maps down with his pointer, and he'd tell us where we were going and what we were going to do, what ordnance we had on board. And I don't know if you all recall this or not. Some of you may be in the Air Force or might have been. The Air Force issued 2 ounces permission flown of liquor to all flying personnel during the war. Always. If you're a sergeant, you flew, every time you flew, the government gave you 2 ounces of liquor. In the back of this briefing room was a big coffee urn, held about 200 cups of coffee and combat liquor set on the table. You're supposed to come in the room, pick up a cup of coffee, brief, go back out, fly your mission, come back, get your double shot of bourbon, take that, and debrief. That's the process you do. Now, I don't know whether there was any coffee in the urn or not. I never seen anybody drink any coffee there. But when he'd get through with that debriefing, that briefing, he'd tell me where we were going, what we were going to do. His last remarks always was this: now, if you get shot down, and that would upset me so bad I couldn't hardly sit back there. Here's what you do, you know, and that scared me to death. So when I'd come out by that thing, I'd take me another double shot of bourbon, and I'd get in that F-84 and go north into Korea and drop him 2 1,000-pound bombs, get rid of that ammunition, and get rid of the rockets, and try to stay alive. And I come back and lied a lot about what all I did, what all I shot out, what all I shot up. And ladies and gentlemen, to get truthful about it, what you have to do if you're going to stay in this program, I didn't even shoot at you unless you got in my way of me getting home. I tell you one thing. Boy, I tried to stay alive. That's the only thing I tried to do, was stay alive up there. And it was the damnedest war I've ever seen. I saw a lot of people killed. I saw a lot of my buddies lost. I saw a lot of civilians killed. Shouldn't have been killed, and I was involved in it. And it was the thing that I drank liquor every day of my life. I tried one day to fly without drinking. I was unable to do it. As I taxied out, I began to throw up over the side of the airplane by reason of being so fearful, and the tower saw me and made me come back and park my airplane because I was sick. And the reason I was sick is I had not had any usual drinks. I never attempted to fly anymore without my usual 5 to 7 drinks in my belt. I drank every day. We had nothing else to do but fly and drink liquor, and that's what I did. There was a Catholic priest, after we moved out of the southern part of Japan, up to Daegu, King 2 Air Force Base at Daegu, Korea. There was a Catholic priest that moved up with us. I had a lot of feelings about this. This Catholic priest moved up with us and stayed with us. And over there, and we left the States with 75 pilots. We lost 38 of our pilots in the first 8 months we were over there. 38 of our guys were killed. This Catholic stayed with us. Every time a guy got killed, he had mass for it the next day. And a little building there on the base. Now, the Baptists, the Presbyterians, and the Methodists, they would fly over from Japan to Korea on Sunday, and they'd sing a few hymns, and they'd fly back. They did not stay over there with us. The chaplains didn't, but this Catholic priest did. And I got the know this guy real well and to love him very much. He drank liquor with us, prayed for us a whole bit, was very supportive of what we were doing. I wrote my mother about the Catholic priest, and of course she got all excited and wrote back, "Don't join the Catholic Church." You know, she got all disturbed about that. And that wasn't it at all. But I began to have some problems over there. I began to hemorrhage from the nose from flying so much altitude, and I was going to have to be operated on. And this guy's name was Father Ford. Call him Padre. I said, Padre, I'm going back to Japan to Nagoya to be operated on. I've been on liquor for over a year on a daily basis. If I go in a hospital, I don't know what'll happen to me. Do you have any connections back at this general hospital where I'm going? He said, Collins, I don't know anybody in Nagoya. I've never been there. But I'll call for him. He got on the phone and called for him. Taegu Korea to Nagoya, Japan, and he got a Catholic priest in this hospital on the phone. He said, I'm sending Lieutenant Collins over to be operated on. Said he's a Baptist and a hopeless case. Don't try to convert him, but bring him some liquor once he gets in the hospital. And I checked in this hospital, and the day I checked in, this major walked in with that cross right there. And he brought me a fifth of liquor every day I was in the hospital. Now think about what I'm saying. If you'd have waited on the Baptist or the Methodist or the Presbyterian to bring you a drink, you'd have died and went to hell. Because they will not do that, and I'm serious. And let me say here now, I needed liquor. Had I not had liquor, I would have gone into DTs. Right in the damn hospital. Nobody might not know what to do for them. We see that happen all the time, you know. I stayed drunk every day in the hospital. I was drunk the day I was operated. Came out of the hospital, came back to Korea, finished my tour. Full-fledged alcoholic, beyond a shadow of a doubt. A lot of alcoholics. I've seen guys that drunk over there that couldn't get an airplane. They'd heap him up in the airplane and strap him in. And let him go. As I said, he's the easiest airplane in the world to fly. Let him go. Let him go because he could fly. Wasn't nothing to it. That damn jet ain't got no torque. His cabin's pressurized. His air conditioned. Old bitch, you just let her get up and let her go. You know, no big deal to it. Had a lot of buddies over there that wound up alcoholics. I checked on a lot of them after I got back. A lot of them were dead. A lot of them died. I went into alcoholism while I was there. Had a son born while I was there. I flew my tour over there, got through that. Time to come home, and I knew I was in trouble, so I asked to come back on board a boat rather than fly back, see if I could get off the liquor, see if I could give me some time. So I came back to Yokohama, caught a boat, but I didn't know what would happen on me out in that Pacific, so I went on board this Navy ship. I threw away half my clothes. I packed 12 40-ounce jugs of Seagram steel in my V4 bag and carried him on board the ship, and I was drunk the entire time back when I crossed the Pacific. I don't remember nothing about it, really. I got back to San Francisco and called out and told I was coming home. I was getting out of the military. Coming home. I came to Savannah, Georgia down there. She and the two little girls met and they left the little baby at home, son. And the girls met me and I had left the States weighing 137 pounds and I drank so much liquor and eat so many sardines and soda crackers. I swelled up like a frog. I had a great big handlebar mustache and it curled up under my eye. Now, I bloated. I could look straight out and see my cheeks. And Ida didn't recognize me when I got off the airplane. And I wanted her to kiss me. I'd been fighting the war, and she didn't want to kiss me, and the young didn't want to kiss me, you know, and it hurt my feelings all there in the terminal and some out. And so on the way home, I stopped and got a fifth of liquor, and I was drunk the first time I laid eyes on my son, CD the third. The first time I ever saw my son, I was drunk. We moved back up here to Marietta, Georgia. Took my job back with the federal government. Again, to go to back to work, and I leave the work every morning going to work. I leave work with a drink in my hand. Now, I don't know any of y'all work for the government or not. I wouldn't want to hurt your feelings, and maybe it's changed since I left there. But in the position I had and with the people I worked with, you could drink. My office had an ironclad rule. If you fell out of the chair, they fired you. If you didn't fall out of your head, it's okay. You drank on the job. They couldn't tell what you were doing. Best job man ever had in his life. They couldn't tell what you were doing. Come on, I said, Collins, what you doing? I said, I'm thinking about his case. They come out a week later. What you doing? I'm thinking about his case. You'll still be thinking a week later. Wouldn't do nothing. Drink right on the job. Didn't have a bit of problem with it at all, except I'd hold on to the chair a lot of times because I was afraid it was going to fall, and I knew they'd fire me. We had a guy who fell out of the chair, and they fired him, you know. A smart guy. Fell out of the chair, and they fired him, so I'd hold on a lot. It got to the point at this stage in my life that Ida could no longer tolerate the situation. We began to do the things we said we never would do in the home. We began to fuss and fight and cuss and carry on in front of it. Children, something that we said we never would do. Yet we began to do these things. And when Ida had been drinking with me, she now stopped. And if you got a wife that's drinking with you, a girlfriend drinking with you, and they quit, boy, you in trouble, showing up in. And she quit. And she began to raise holy hell. So the way I got around that is I just wouldn't come home. I don't know what y'all ever done that. I wouldn't come home. I'd be gone three or four, stay at a hotel in Atlanta. I'd go to work every day. And of course, I had to work to keep the money coming. Every alcoholic's going to work. The last thing he'll do is give up his job. he'll do anything before he gives up the job. You know, he'll tell you right now. I said, hell, I never have missed any work. What are you talking about? I ain't got no liquor problem. I was at work every day. But I needed a check and so I could buy the liquor. It got to the point, though, that Ida could no longer tolerate it all, and so she moved to Statesboro, Georgia, where we now live, and divorced me for her habitual drunkenness. And I say this, but not as a joke at all. If you're ever in Statesboro, Georgia, and you go in our local courthouse, it's right on the square there, you can go in the record room and you can read about me. Because I'm a certified drunkard. It tells you right on the record there. It'll be there forever. She divorced me as a habitual drunkard. And I could not visit my children if I was on the influence of liquor. That's the way the decree read. Left me up here in Atlanta, Georgia. I moved in with my sister, and I was in Statesboro, Georgia. Things got so rough in Atlanta, I moved over to Birmingham and got with Social Security over there in a legal capacity. Got over there and got trying to stay drunk, trying to work. And any of y'all who are alcoholics, there's nothing as hard as trying to work and stay drunk all at the same time. That's a full-time job. It takes every waking moment to do it, you know, to figure it out. I went to Alabama and I got over there. And right across from the Social Security area office that I worked in, straight across the street, 50 steps, there was Louis Grill and Louis sold liquor and miniatures, a little small 2-ounce bottle, up to a half pint in Alabama. I don't know what they do now. But you could go in and buy the miniatures. And I got over and I tipped all the waitresses $1 the first time they waited on me. I tipped everyone $1 I needed to get their attention. And I got their attention with $1 because $1 was a lot of money then. Then I set it up to where when we came in on the 10 o'clock morning break, all these lawyers sat around a big round table. Then she'd put me a double shot of bourbon in a coffee cup, put the cream on the side and a spoon, and slide that to me. But you got to remember to blow it. You got to act like it's hot, sip it. Because if you don't, they know you're drinking liquor, you know. Sip it. And that way I'd get a double shot of bourbon at 10 o'clock, another double shot at noon, another double shot at 3 o'clock, and I'd get through the day that way. Then at 5 o'clock, I'd walk right back in the same place, right out of my office, 50 steps across the street, walk right in and order half a pint of Seagram's VO that cost $2.20. Now, I remember the price. Never will forget it, but it'll be 900 years old. Louis, who ran the grill, was a Greek. I told Louis, I said, Louis, all of my funds are tied up by reason of this divorce. The hell, there wasn't no fun, but I told Louis that. And I'm going to need a little credit. He said, why, certainly, Mr. Collins, with the job you got, you can get all the credit you want. So he began to credit. And I was over about less than 6 months, and I charged over $1,000 worth of liquor in Louis' grill at half a price. I never even go to the liquor store. Now, this tells you something, you know, if you think about it. This tells you something. But let me tell you what happened to me. Here's to get into the good part. I believe in my own particular case, I joined the church as a young man, and I believe in a supreme being, and I'm not trying to sell you on God or church or nothing. But I believe in God. I believe God began to try to get C.D. Collins' attention, and things began to happen to me, and I thank God today for them, that they began to happen to me. And it was things like this. Two men came into my office one day, came in and asked my secretary, said, we'd like to see Mr. Collins. She said, fine. And she brought him back into the office and introduced me to him. They told me what their names were. And they said, would you mind riding downtown with us, Mr. Collins? I said, why, certainly not. I'd be glad to. And I told my secretary, I said, evidently they have a case down in the local office they want somebody to look at. And I'll go down and look at it. So when I'm getting this plain black Ford, and we drive downtown in the middle of Birmingham, Alabama. We pull up in front of this huge gray building and everybody gets out. I'm in the back seat and the two sitting up front. They had plain clothes, shirt and tie and all that. Well, get out. We got out, sat out, I closed the door and looked right above the building. It says, Birmingham Jail. I screamed like a stuck hog. I hollered as loud as I could. Oh, no. And God grabbed me like that boy and walked right in the door to Birmingham Jail with me. I know none of y'all have ever been locked up, but it's one of the most impressive things I think can happen to a human being. And I recommend it to a lot of people. A lot of people get mad at me in Statesboro because I tell a woman, I said, lock him up. You know, lock him up. I'll get his attention. But they take a picture from the front and one from the side. I want y'all to bet that, no? Fingerprint you, and they put you in a bullpen. It's about 10 o'clock in the morning. They put me in a bullpen, about 150 other guys, look like. And since you've never been in jail, let me tell you what's the first question. The jailer slammed over, locked him, walked off. And let me tell you the first question answered. Someone said, what are you in for? I said, the warrant said child support. Said, Judge Smith will give you 5 years of hard labor for that. said, he's going to put you on the chain gang. I like to die right there. I thought, God, I'm going to go on the chain gang and burn them out of my mouth. A professional bondman got down, came down and got me out that afternoon, and I came out of that jail. And I never did go back to my office. I left everything in the world I had there. Pen, pencil, set up, and never did go back to office. I called my father in Atlanta, Georgia, and he came and got me. I went home to Mama. I'm 34 years of age, and I go home to Mama. Now, Mama said the reason I drank liquor is because I live with Ida. Said anybody who lived with Ida would drink liquor. They got a legitimate reason, because she's a Kennedy. So I don't have Ida when I get home. And it didn't take Mama about a week to realize what she had. You know, and have one of y'all been through this. And I heard my mother tell my daddy one morning, his name was C.D., except they called him Clifford. I heard him, she said, Clifford, I want you to load him up in that car and carry him down to Statesboro, Georgia. And whatever it takes, you get Ida to take him back. Because she's the only one mean enough to live with him, so get him out of here. So my daddy loaded me up in that car and carried me down to Statesboro, Georgia. We checked in a little motel there. We go around to see Ida. And every time we go around to see Ida, it's like pouring turpentine on a cat. Now, you got to beat him south. She just get all excited and go jumping up and down and cussing and talking ugly, you know, and coming me and my daddy. And she had some cuss words. I told her I wished I could have taped them because I believe you could have sold them to the military. Something I never had even heard. And she described me with all these adjectives, and then her last remark was this, and you're sorry as hell. And I couldn't handle that. I could handle everything, but you're sorry as hell. I said, I'm not sorry. I've always worked, and I've always made good money. You know, you're still sorry, she said. And this thing went on, we're not even sure how long. Well, days, me and my dad go by every day. And she'd get so mad, she'd run and grab the telephone and start dialing the damn phone. She said, I'm going to have you put on chain gang. I said, well, if y'all are, I want you to have me put on the chain gang here, where when I come on that truck every day, I can wave at my children, you know. That's the way I felt about it. And it was one of them deals where I'd gone as far as I was going. You know, to make a long story short again, I didn't tell this, Danny knows what I'm going to tell. I didn't tell this for the first 23 years. We were in AA, and one night in AA meeting in Swainsboro, Georgia, she's sitting right where you are. I said, I'm going to tell it like it really happened. She turned red as a damn beet. I thought, I may get killed right here. She didn't have a gun with us. I thought, well, I won't get right now. My father paid my ex-wife in cold cash money to remarry me. How much? She needed money. Yeah, money talks to Ida still does today, I felt. She still said, he didn't pay me enough. She'll tell you that today. He didn't pay me enough. But he paid her. And she said, I'll remarry. I ain't got a damn bit of use for it. That's what she said. I ain't got a bit of use for it, but I'll remarry because I need the money. So we remarried up in the Baptist church. Statesboro, Georgia, right next to the post office. On a Saturday. And it wasn't a festive thing. Nobody was throwing rice or laughing or anything. It was like a damn funeral. You know, nobody wanted to go. And I had to come down the aisle with three children following. And the little boy kept saying, Mama, what's going on? And he kept asking what's going on. She's trying to shush him, you know. And so we remarried there in that Baptist church. And I never sit in that church today that I don't think about her coming down that aisle and think about what went on there. Hard to believe. But let me tell you what I said. Let me get on my story. I told her, I said, don't ever mention liquor to me again as long as you live. I never want to hear the word. I'm through forever. So we were remarried. And we're going to go off on a little short honeymoon down to Savannah, 50 miles away. So we started down towards Savannah. We owned a borrowed car, borrowed money. Got about 8 or 10 miles out of town. Old brain started working, you know, again. I said, listen, since we're on our honeymoon, would it be all right if we had a drink today, you know? And I didn't find out the later to the truth of this thing. She said, yeah, if you don't get drunk. Of course, she was wanting a drink herself because she was dreading the whole deal too, see? So we stopped and got a fifth of liquor in Brooklyn, Georgia, and both got roaring drunk. We were drunk 4 hours after we got married, both of us drunk. Now, this was embarrassing, humiliating, the whole deal. We came back the next day terribly upset about what had happened. And I went to work with the Department of Transportation. I had lost everything in the world in the legal field. Went to work with the Department of Transportation, cutting bushes, driving stakes, chaining, doing this type of work. Lucky to have a job of any kind. Trying to stay sober. Stayed sober for a few weeks, got back on liquor again. And this is the last year of my drinking prior to coming in AA. Let me say, ladies and gentlemen, it's one of the most horrible experiences I've had in my life. When I started back this town, everything goes. And I don't know why, if you're an alcoholic like I am, then you'll understand some of it you won't. Once I started drinking, now I will do anything in order to continue to drink. I don't care what's necessary. I'll write you a bad check. I'll steal. I'll do whatever's necessary. Once I start. Once I get the thing started, and I'm gone, I'll do whatever. And this is what has begun to happen. That I begin to give bad checks to all the liquor stores. I begin to charge liquor. I begin to do whatever was necessary in order to drink liquor. I come to a lot of times on the floor. I'd fall into the living room. And I'd see my two little girls walk out the door and step by their daddy's head. And I'd open my eyes and I'd see those worn-out shoes and those shattered dresses that those two little girls had on. And ladies and gentlemen, I couldn't handle it. And I told this to my minister, and it blew his mind. I said, I couldn't handle it. I'd have to get up and go get more liquor. He said, God, look like you'd never drink again. That was his answer. Look like you'd never drink. I'd have to come off the floor and go get more liquor to stop the wheels in my head from turning. I don't know about y'all. I got to the point in my life that I didn't know what had happened to me. I could not believe what had happened to me. I wondered if I ever had a decent job. Was I ever a decent human being? You know, was I ever anything? I would walk in the alleys in Statesboro, Georgia. I wouldn't walk on the main street. You know, I was so ashamed and embarrassed. I'd become a bumbling, stumbling drunk.
I could not drink. No way in the world to keep up. And I thank God today that we have information on TV, radio, everywhere now, and signs and books and magazines telling, hey, there's a cure. You can arrest your disease. Not cure it, but you can arrest it. Thank God we know that today. They didn't know that then. I had no information about it all. Everything began to go between me and Ida. In our home, we began to fight physically, not me, she. Began to have all kinds of problems. It got to the point I could no longer get liquor anywhere, and it had warrants torn out for me, and I began to buy liquor over on the Geechee River from a bootleg over there that made syrup look good. Every now and then I run into somebody that knows about syrup looking. I see some guys, their heads start bobbling down. I thought, old man, you ain't ever tried syrup liquor, you ain't never lived. You would never buy half a pint of syrup liquor. Never. Because first thing, you're going to throw up. When you drink it, you throw up. But if you ever catch your breath and hold on real tight and it lays down, then you can go with it. You know, it's just like old granddaddy in there. But you're going to have a problem for about the first half a pint. Trying to get some of it to stick. Once it sticks, it's sold for $4 a gallon. And the aroma from it is so bad that if you sleep on a mattress, you have to throw the mattress away. And I had a sister came on when I first got on the set, but she came over the house and when she won't know, she said, you see how that smell, you know? And of course, I knew what it was, and I didn't see, you know? I said, I don't know. She said, well, that's the darndest old I've ever smelled in my life. You know, it was me. Because once you get drunken, you take 10 baths a day, and you can't get rid of it. And when you walk outside, the yellow jackets, the honeybees, just swarming around his nostrils. God, you can't believe it. They light right in your mouth. He's spitting out. He ain't going to sing you nothing, but he wants some of that stuff, you know? That sweet, sickening smell. And that's when Ida moved me out of the house and onto the back porch in a little closet. And she said, Peggy, it wasn't no bed, it was a closet. You know, just big enough to get you in there. Had one little window by a dig. And a little 40-watt bulb hung down on the string. And that's why I come off of these drunks back in that room. And I hope, pray to God, I never forget that. Never forget that. That's why I come off the drunks. We had a lady who was looking after the children. And Ida was working, making a living, and I was flat on my back. And I asked him, my friend who's a doctor, most of you all know him here in Atlanta, I asked him one time, I said, I don't know what it is about coming off of a drunk. You've been drunk for weeks too. You don't have to breathe very much. Y'all ever notice this? When you're near dead anyway, you just take a little air, you just take, and you wait a while, you know, you're not big hurt. Just wait a few minutes, you just take a little bit more, you know. And ain't no moon, ain't nothing, so you can hear dead. And this lady come out teaching the window, you know, and she couldn't see no movement, and she get all excited. She'd run in and call out and say, Miss Collins, he's dead today, you know. All excited about it. I went in and she said, don't worry about it, I said, don't want to get home. I'd come home and they'd get both come out teaching the window, see if I was breathing, you know. And I'd have said sometimes she'd watch. It seemed like, you know, 5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah.
I said, Rick, she'd see a slight move. She'd say, that SOB's not dead. Maybe he'll be dead tonight. You know, very hopeful about the whole deal, you know. She prayed to God that I would die. Now, think about what I'm saying, because my daddy paid her to take me back. There wasn't no way she could give me. The only way she'd get rid of me is me die. And she prayed to God she'd get on these nights. God, take it. Let him die tonight. You know, let him go. You know, get rid of that damn joker. Because there wasn't no way to get rid of it. And while we in this type of deal, you know, we read about in Atlanta Journal, there was a treatment center in Atlanta Journal out on Washington, on South Cliff Road. A.O. Lacey Chandler's home. Dr. Vernell Fox out of the Cleveland Trial College. And I read about it in the journal. And I said, I want to go there. And I didn't know what they did then. I didn't know whether to beat you with hoses, give you the water treatment, put you in padded cells, strip you. Now, I didn't know what they did. I had no idea. But later, him and I wanted out. I wanted out. I was one of these few people, and I was end of line in alcoholism. Let me say, I was at the point where I was going to die. You know, I could no longer live because I saw Dr. Morris draw the graph on the blackboard. I don't know if you've ever seen this or not. Dr. Morris drew a graph from the first bench down to the bottom of the graph. In the bottom of the graph, he's got a casket, bars, and AA. And you can pick yourself out on the graph where you are in alcoholism. And I was at the bottom of the graph. Now, John Mooney and I both saw Earl Marsh give this deal at a convention in Jackson, Florida when John first sobered up. Anyway, I was at the end of the line of alcoholism, and I had to get out if I was going to live, and I know that beyond a shadow of a doubt today, and that's the reason I'm here today, ladies and gentlemen. I do whatever I'm asked to do in A, because if I drink again, I will die. I will never sober up again. Anyway, I came to Atlanta, Georgia, went through that treatment in Atlanta, Georgia. It was a 28-day program. I came up room with a guy from worked at Atlanta Journal. His name was Sandy Sanderson. I was telling some people about last night, some guy, a new guy. He wrote for the Atlanta Journal. He covered the Nuremberg trials, a brilliant man, and he and I had a room. We were in that two-door room, and we went through this treatment center with Dr. Vernell Fox. And the staff met every day and gave a report. And the staff meet every day, and they call out each patient's name and said, what do you think? What do you think? You ask the nurse and everybody with them. And I had a female woman counselor, an elderly doctor. They never gave me a favorable report the entire time I was there. They said, Collins won't make it. Collins won't make it. Sanderson made it. Sanderson made it. They thought he might stay sober. They'd give me a chance at all of surviving. And yet when I came out of that place, they extended me from 28 days to 6 weeks. And I never feared how I reacted to this. I got terribly disturbed, mad as hell in the home. I said, I got to get home. I got to get home and make a living, my wife and children. I got to get out of here. I've been here 28 days. That's what you said. And then they asked me the question, the key deal. I said, what have you been doing for the last year, Carl? I said, well, I've been drunk. They said, well, what difference does it make if you're going to stay another week or two? So I stayed, and I thank God I did. I stayed the full time as long until they discharged me. And I came out of that hospital and came back to Statesboro, Georgia. I had filed for the second divorce, and all it had to do was a judge signed an order, and it was true. She told me not to come back to Statesboro. I never want to lay eyes on you again. You're no damn good. Don't come down here. Stay up in Atlanta with your mother and daddy. I went back to Statesboro anyway. I lived in the basement of a hotel. Paid $5 a week for a room to sleep down there. Got my job back cutting bushes with the highway department. Back to work with them, call a ride back to work every day, and we'd go by to see Ida and the children. She'd let me come by and see them. She said she saw a change in me. I told her, I said, here's a key to the thing, Danny. I said, I don't know why I can stay sober or not. But I'm going to try it on a daily basis. This is what they told me to do. They told me to get involved in AA and try on a daily basis. And I hope and pray to God you guys are here. If we got anybody young, new in AA, you're the person I'm talking to, not talking to these old people. But here's what you can do. Anybody can do anything for one day. I found this out. You know, I can stand on my head for one day if it's necessary. And that's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous is so simple it blows your mind. The simplicity of it. The simplicity of it. Now, I've been around a long time. It is so simple. And yet guys come in, everybody, they want to complicate it. They want to interpolate and they want to, you know, philosophize and all this crap. It's so simple it blows your mind. Don't drink liquor. Pray to a God, whoever, and treat your fellow man right, and attend meetings to try to hit the fellow man, you'll be okay. It is a living problem. I no longer have a drinking problem.
I got a living problem out of them. You know, I got a living problem. And I'm in a program that handles it. I thank God today that I'm an alcoholic. I thank God that I'm sorry for what happened. But I thank God that I'm an alcoholic. Because I found a way to live. A way to live. And a lot of people don't have a way to live. I've got a way to live. That I can live and function on a daily basis. Well, I'm okay. Right here. On the inside. I got sober. I got involved in AA. We attended the first meeting of AA when it started AA in Statesboro, Georgia. And I've been here ever since. Ever since. I go to 5 closed meetings a week now. 5 closed and 2 speakers meetings. And I thoroughly enjoy it. It's not a chore. It's not something that I have to do. I go down and sit with a bunch of young people. And I look at these young women and young men who are coming in this thing. And God, what a thrill it is to see people begin to get their lives together. Some 18, 17, 18. We had one kid, 13 years old. Sober, been sober now 3 years. Got all these kids, a lot of them back in college. We got one gal that was sleeping in the damn woods. She's now an honor student out at Georgia Southern College. You know? Shooting straight in the vein, too. Drinking, looking, shooting herself in the vein. So that's the reason I'm involved in it, ladies and gentlemen. I thank God I'm an alcoholic and I go wherever I'm asked to go to say, hey, you can do it. If I can do it, anybody can do it. I'm not smart. Let me sit up here and say, hell no, I'm not smart. I wanted to be smart. I wanted to be governor of the state of Georgia was my ambition in life. To be governor of the state of Georgia. And I probably could have been governor of the state of Georgia had I not turned out to be alcoholic. But let me say here now another statement. You may not buy it all. I wouldn't swap places today with Joe Frank Harris. I wouldn't swap places with him. I'd rather be where I'm standing tonight talking to you people. Or rather be sitting down out there in the AME than be governor of the state of Georgia. Because Joe Frank Harris will never know what I know. He will never know what I know unless he does what I've done. Never. There's no way. There's no way he can learn to live like I'm living. You know. All the portion of chapter 5 is read as one of the most profound pieces of information ever been put on a piece of paper. It blows my mind of what it says. They said if there's one word that Bill Wilson would have changed, he would have changed the word from rarely to never have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover, people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. Honest with themselves. Not anybody else. Honest with themselves. I've never seen but one man in 30 years that was in AA that couldn't get the program. He was mentally deranged the way he didn't know when he was. He's the only man I've ever seen that didn't have enough sense. I know 3 people in AA have been sober over 20 years that cannot read and write today. Still cannot read and write. They're sober in AA today. Now think about that. Think about that. Sober in AA today. Can't read or write. But they're sober living good lives today. It's a beautiful program. I don't know how y'all feel about it. I'm not trying to sell you anything. I tell you how I feel. That's all. CD the way he feels. I got a wife that hated the damn ground I walked on, that wanted to kill me. And we when I got sober, let me say, it wasn't a bed of roses, ladies and gentlemen. I wasn't a nice guy the next day and her a nice woman. No way. It took us 5 years to get the marriage going again with me sober. I walked out the door many nights going to AA meetings and her cursing. She's bitter at the world because we had lost everything in the world we had. We had junky furniture, junky house, junky automobile. You could have bought us out for $250, the whole deal, you know. And yet I come into this program and do what y'all told me to do. That's all. Do what you told me to do. Stay sober and do the best I could on a daily basis. And all of the promises have come true in my life. Every single one of them. While I was divorced from Ida, sometime I forget to tell this, right? I was in Dobbins Air Force Base, drunk downtown one night on Peachtree in a bar down there. I forgot the name of the bar. I run into a nice looking lady. And I said, would you like to take a ride in the jet? She said, well, I certainly would. I said, well, let's go. So we drove back out to Dobbins Air Force Base. I took her, this is 35 years ago, I took her in there and put her on a white suit and I put her on a G suit and I put her on a helmet where they couldn't recognize the woman. They put her head up hair upon her and I took her up in a T-33 jet. So drunk I couldn't even sign the clearance. And they turned the clearance over to Colonel Wilson, who later made general. And the next time I reported for duty, Colonel Wilson called me in, said, Lieutenant Collins, is this you? I said, yes. He said, were you drinking? I said, well, certainly I was. I didn't mind.
I said, I flew 100 missions drunk. I don't. He said, not in my damn outfit, you don't. And I'm going to court-martial you and throw you out of here. But he said, since you fought in two wars, I'll give you an opportunity to resign your commission.
And I resigned my commission and I was out of the military. All of it gone. I lost wife, profession, the military, the whole bit had gone. But the point I want to make to you, the promises, I got back in Alcoholics Anonymous, I got sober. Like all alcoholics, we don't take no very well. I don't know about y'all. We don't handle no well at all. I don't. I applied to get back in the military. They said no. I went, got on a damn airplane, went to the Pentagon. Washington, D.C., went in and talked to a four-star general, General Campbell. And I told General Campbell, I'm an alcoholic. And I said, I fought in two wars, and I want to fly for the military again. And I got in trouble. Look, I no longer drink. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, Mr. Collins, you go back down and reapply. And I come back down and reapply, and they let me back in the National Guard. And I flew for another 16 years for them. I went through helicopter school when I was 50 years old, and nobody had ever been that old. I went through a bunch of guys in their 20s. I was 50. And I never will forget the day I reported over at Fort Rucker, and this guy looked back. I thought, I'm still not 50 mentally yet. He looked back and said, how old are you? I looked around kind of funny. He said, you? I said, 50. He said, what in the hell are you doing here? I said, I'm going through helicopter school. He said, you must be crazy. I said, I am crazy. You know what I mean? And I hung in there with those guys and went through chopper school. You know, with the guys in their 20s. And I had over there with me a little small son. I went through chopper school. And if I hadn't been with him, I got drunk and quit. But she was with me, and I hung in there and went AA on a regular basis and went through chopper school. I learned to fly helicopters, flew them for the last 10 years of my military. And they gave me one to carry home. I was a good friend with Ernie Vandenberg. He and I had flown together. They gave me a helicopter and I carried it to Statesboro. A military helicopter with a red government credit card, and I landed in my backyard the first time I went out there. And the damn city police come out with the blue lights all going, state patrol all going. They all got excited. But they got used to it. I just stopped by and get a cup of coffee with Ida. What are you doing? I said, I want to drink a cup of coffee with Ida, and then I'm going on. And they got used to that deal. So what I'm saying is, beyond your wildest dreams, what will happen to you if you get sober? If I had been able, in my drunken stupor, which most of us have laid in bed and thought about what I'd like to have and what I'd like to do in my drunken stupor, if I'd been able to write it out later in the morning, it wouldn't have come out one-tenth as well as it has. As well as it has. I stayed with the Department of Transportation. I eventually got back in legal field, handling land condemnations for them. Vince got a decent job with the Department of Transportation. Flew for the military again, as I said, flew another 16 years for them. Came out, retired out of the Department of Transportation. Went to work at a hospital and doing something I thoroughly enjoy. I really enjoy it more than anything we've ever done. Got three airplanes to fly for the hospital, and Ida let me buy my own. And I choose to say that Ida let me buy my own because she loved me. A lot of people say it's because you got so much insurance. I don't know what you did. But I got me a fully acrobatic airplane now, and it's Sunburst. Y'all all have seen them. It's Sunburst, the most beautiful thing you ever laid your eyes on. And it's got an inverted fuel system, inverted oil system. It'll fly upside down just like we're right side up. I just put it on its back and go out down the main drag to Statesboro. And everybody waves at you. Who is that idiot? If that's old CD, you know, what the hell? I don't care. But I thoroughly enjoy it. And this is what AA has given me. I don't mean to be bragging. This is what getting sober is given CD Collins. The freedom to do what I want to do, you know, as long as I don't infringe on anybody else's right. And I thank God for that. And the word L-O-V-E, love, one of the most used, misused, and abused words in the English language is the word love. Think about what I'm saying. And yet, through the program Alcoholics Anonymous, I have found the real meaning of love. For the first time in my life, I use love for everything in the world. And y'all see it on every kind of signboard, every kind of magazine, whatever. I found the real meaning of love. To love one human being without asking anything in return. Without asking anything in return. Don't care what race, creed, or color, what religious background, and hey, I love you. And I hope you understand where I'm going. Love you. And that's what it's all about. I come to you last night and saw a big man that I hadn't seen in several months.
And we hugged and shed some tears. And ladies and gentlemen, if you can't cry, I really don't have any use for you. I'll be honest with you. If you can't shed tears, as far as I'm concerned, you missed it. God, I can cry. Because I love people enough to cry. You know, most cleansing thing in the world. We had a lot of problems since I got sober. And if you stay sober and live in this world, you'll have problems. So don't think everything's been beautiful all this period of time at that time. We had death in the family, money trouble, child trouble. And my son, my oldest son, the boy that was born while I was in Korea, the medical profession told us, I would not tell this about us here because you can't handle it yet, told us that this boy would not make it. He got on drugs and a whole bit. Said he would not make it. But guess what? Come to the decision. See, to you and I, this boy is not going to live. And we prayed to God for him. We didn't pray for him to live. We prayed for what was best for him. We prayed for God. What's best for our son, Lord? We didn't ask God to let him live. But today this boy is sober. He got sober. He got off of drugs. He went back to college. He got his own education. He's a certified public accountant. He's married and has two little girls. He's in church and Sunday school every Sunday. And he's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the night I gave him a white chip in AA, I told the group, and nobody understands this unless you've been around, I said, I wouldn't take $1 million cash for being able to handle my son a white chip. Because now he has a way to live. A way to live where he's going to be okay. You know, I would take $1 million for him to come into the Alcoholics Anonymous. Put his arm around me, crooked up, hey, Daddy, I love you. And he didn't speak to me for 5 years. He's on a damn motorcycle. He had a long hair in it all the time, and not a full beard. And he rode it on the back wheel most of the damn time when I got over. We didn't speak for years. So, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know about y'all. God still performs miracles today like they were 2,000 years ago. And if you don't look at them and you don't see them, and I see them every day of my life, every day of my life I see miracles performed in this world. And I thank God I'm a part of an organization or fellowship, let me say, that sees it and is trying to help people. I go wherever. I go to talk to one person, two people. I don't give a damn where it is. Whatever you ask me to do, I do it. The only reason I don't go is I got a conflict. That's all. That's all. I don't know, I go wherever we ask to go. And that's what it's all about, ladies and gentlemen. That's what it's all about. I have not set the words on the fire from a financial standpoint. No big deal. I got a decent home to live in. Got an automobile. You know, and got some retirement money enough to live on. No big deal. You know, I wouldn't trade places with a living soul in the world. There, I envy nobody. I envy anybody. I don't say, well, I wish I liked him and had his money. No, sir. I mean, I'm satisfied with CD College. I have inner peace right here. This is what this program has given me. I get on my knees and pray to God on a daily basis and say, hey, Lord, help me. Do your will. I don't pray for anything. Do your will, whatever that is. Yeah. That's my prayer, very simple prayer. Do your will. That's what it's all about. Now, when I die, and I will die, I know damn well I haven't got much longer to live, and I don't worry a lot about that and all. I hope, I know and feel in my own mind, somebody will walk by my casket and say, C.D. tried to help his fellow man. That's the highest compliment you'll ever pay a human being. I'd rather somebody say that about me than erect a statue to me on the Capitol Square down to where Gene Talmadge is. I'd rather they say he tried to help his fellow man while he's here. Because that's what it's all about, ladies and gentlemen. That's what it's all about. Try to help your fellow man in this world. I thank God I'm a part of a fellowship that does this. Somebody help me. If they hadn't helped me, I wouldn't be here today. I'd have been dead years and years ago. And it has. I've gotten sober and the children are educated and they're all doing okay, you know. Not an I okay today. Certainly, as I said, we've had some problems. But this program is guaranteed to work under all conditions. That's what the man told me in the first convention I attended in Augusta, Georgia. It's guaranteed to work under all conditions. It's foolproof. You can lose your health, your wealth, your wife, and everything can go down the tube. But if you work the program, you will not drink liquor. Take dope. And I bought it and I found this to be true in my own life. I have never entertained the idea of returning to the bottle. I've never entertained the idea about the reason this has happened, I believe I'll go get drunk. It's never occurred to me. I've done an awful lot of praying, and every time I've ever prayed in desperation, I got an answer. I throw this out to you. If you pray in desperation, you get an answer. You get an answer.
I'd done this. I walked across out of a bedroom, walked across the hall to stick a .38 pistol in my mouth after I'd been sober 15 years to blow my brains out. And as I walked across the hall to pick the gun up to stick in my mouth that was laying between the mattresses in mine out of the bedroom, as across the hall, a thought occurred to me, why don't you do what you tell everybody to do, C.D., is pray. And I went in and fell on my knees and laid my head down where the gun was. And my prayer to God was, God, I can't handle this. I cannot handle this. And immediately I had a feeling that everything was going to be okay. And ladies and gentlemen, it was. It was. I looked back a year later, and everything was fine. Everything was fine. So if you knew, for God's sake, stick around and listen to these people and listen. I get more out of listening to y'all than I do of talking to myself. Listen to y'all are the ones that kept C.D. Collins sober. That's what it's all about. And I found the real meaning of love, because I love every human being. I don't give a dang what race, creed, or color. I love people and I want to help people. That's what it's all about, ladies and gentlemen. And I have lived in such a way, so when my summons comes to join that innumerable cavern, which moves to the mysterious realm where each of us will take our place in the silent chambers of death, I will go not like some quarry slave driven to his dungeon, but sustained in sooth as an old man who lies down in pleasant dreams and wakes no more. That's what it's all about. Thank you.